about 300 pounds, without an ounce of fat on him. He had a square jaw and a dark forelock, which barely concealed a swastika tattoo. "Hey, Rocco," said one of the guards as he tossed me to the cold gray floor, "we got some fresh meat for you." "Don't you believe 'em, Rocco," I said. "They took all my fresh meat in the other room, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're going to eat it themselves." Rocco looked me over as the guards left. "What are you in for?" he asked. I explained the whole situation with Sarah Silverman and Dave Attell, and then I asked him the same.
"Triple murder," he said.
I was shocked. Any fool knows you can't murder a man more than once. And I told Rocco as much. He'd been railroaded on those last two counts, and I let him know I'd be more than happy to become his jailhouse lawyer and dedicate my life to gaining his freedom. After all, becoming a jailhouse lawyer had been a boyhood dream of mine, and here I was with an opportunity to make it come true. I knew logically that Rocco was completely innocent of at least two of the crimes he'd been convicted of, and I believed in my heart that he was most likely innocent of the other one, too. After all, if a man is innocent of two murders, odds are he's innocent of the third. That's just grade school arithmetic. I couldn't wait to get in front of that jury. I planned to go to the prison library first thing in the morning and start reading law books. And I'd had a little head start, too. You see, I had seen every single episode of Matlock many times over. "I'll set you free, Rocco. I promise you that." Rocco started to get real excited at this news. He told me his first lawyers had convinced him to plead guilty. We both agreed that's the last thing anyone should ever do. We were on the same wavelength, and that's important when it comes to a lawyer and his client. The first thing I suggested was that he lose the swastika tattoo. I didn't care personally about a man's politics, but if there's one thing I'd learned from watching Matlock, it was this. Juries hate Hitler. Rocco claimed that he had just picked his tattoo out of a prison tattoo book.
"Is there anything we can do?" he asked.
"Well, sure. I can just modify the tattoo. I'll add some lines to it and easily make it into a tic-tac-toe board."
"That sounds good," said Rocco. But then he began to look troubled. When I asked him what was wrong, Rocco said, "I was just wondering if the tic-tac-toe board is associated with another wicked man from history."
I smiled. "Do you consider Wink Martindale historically wicked?" Rocco let out a roar of laughter.
"Everyone loves Wink Martindale."
And for the first time, I could see a glimmer of genuine hope. The next day, I went to the prison library to study, but I was disheartened when I found out that law books are long. Long books make me sleepy. A great lawyer must know his weaknesses, and I knew almost all of mine. I decided that instead of struggling through those books, I would rely on my vast knowledge of Ben Matlock's work. So Rocco and I began to practice courtroom scenarios in our small cell. I started by asking Rocco straight out if he was guilty of any of the three murders.
"Oh, I'm guilty, all right. That's for sure. And the funny thing is, I got no remorse. I'd do it again tomorrow."
After hearing this, I made a key decision. Rocco would not be taking the stand. Our courtroom preparation had come to an end, and I felt ready to defend him before the judge. The next day, I changed Rocco's tattoo from a swastika to a tic-tac-toe board. And while I was at it, I went one step further. Using Rocco's wide, heavily muscled back as my canvas, I used my needle and green ink to fashion a beautiful image of Wink Martindale in a checkered suit, asking a contestant a maddeningly easy question. But that night, Rocco woke me up with bad news. He told me he couldn't go through with the appeal.
He'd been in the joint so long, he was downright institutionalized. He confessed that he was afraid of freedom. I couldn't understand where he was coming from. I missed my freedom more than anything. I loved my freedom. And here in the Hooskow, they were pretty stingy when it came to any freedom whatsoever. Then Rocco explained the difference between the outside and the inside to me. On the outside, a man rises to power using his ambition and cunning. On the inside, you make your way up the ropes one way and one way only, by the number of fellows you can rape. That's why, within the jail, Rocco's name was spoken in hushed tones. He was a raper's raper. He was staying right here in prison, he told me, because inside he had the necessary skills to command respect and prestige, but outside he was a nobody. I was no longer his lawyer, just another prisoner, and if I knew what was good for me, I'd better start raping. Now, I'd never raped anybody before, and in the free world, I had worn that fact as a badge of honor, mentioning it proudly and loudly at dinner parties and social events. Folks admired me for it. Say what you will about old Norm, my friends would often say, but he won't rape you. Every time I heard that, it'd make me feel good inside, like a warm shot of whiskey. But here in the penitentiary, the rules had been turned upside down. I wanted to fit in, but the problem was that I didn't care much for sex with men. I liked men fine when it came to watching football games with them and eating Cheetos and playing video games, but when it came to having sex with them, I just had to grin and bear it.
You got it all wrong, Norm, Rocco explained. Rape has nothing to do with sex. It's all about power, buddy.
I gotta admit, when Rocco first told me that, I thought it was about the damn foolish thing a man could say. But the more I chewed on it, the more sense it started to make. Rape was all about making the other guy feel small. Then I'd look big and strong beside him. I'd done similar things in the free world plenty, spraying a handful of quarters onto a busy thoroughfare and laughing as the homeless bums dodged cars and trucks to earn their supper. I had always felt really big inside when I'd done that, and apparently that's what raping a fellow in prison felt like, or so Rocco told me. So I made up my mind then and there that as soon as the opportunity availed itself, I would take ungentlemanly advantage of some hapless prisoner. I got my opportunity while I was working one night in the machine shop, and I looked over, and there stood Marvin Adelman. Marvin was doing a 5-year bid for securities and exchange fraud. He had large black glasses, thinning gray hair, and whiskers that made him look just like a rodent with large black glasses. I shouted at him loud so all my fellow inmates could hear, "Hey, Adelman, I'm going to rape you the same way you raped the people who invested all their money in your Ponzi schemes. The only difference is, whereas you rape them in a metaphorical sense, I'm setting out to..." I stopped my speech. Marvin had fled. I had made the biggest mistake of the novice raper. I had made my intentions known. The whole yard laughed at me as I turned beet red. I took off in an embarrassed rage, determined that I would rape Marvin Adelman before the sun touched the horizon. It took a while, but I finally located Marvin, cowering behind a belt sander. This was a good sign. Whenever a guy is cowering, you know you have the upper hand. I started chasing him, but he was fast and elusive, like a jackrabbit wearing large black glasses. I'd run at him full speed, thinking I finally had him, but at the last moment he'd duck to his left or his right, and I'd go crashing into a wall. I was dog-tired and gasping heavily when I finally got him cornered, and as I made a final lunge toward him, I tripped and hit my head on a belt sander. I don't know how long I was out, but when I regained consciousness, the first thing I heard was the laughter. I looked around, and all the prisoners were beside themselves with delight, laughing and poking each other in the sides. The only man who was not laughing was Rocco. He sat in a chair way in the back, but he was close enough that I could see the disappointment in his eyes. I couldn't make sense of any of it, but then I turned around and saw what had the boys in the black and white pajamas convulsing in this mass paroxysm of mirth. There behind me was Marvin Adelman, all 130 pounds of him. And what do you suppose Marvin was doing that was so funny that he had everybody busting a gut? Well, he was raping me, that's what. He was raping the hell out of me. You know, I had never understood the concept of irony before, but I guess that this was it all right, and I was not a fan. "Get the hell off me, Adelman, and enough with the raping," I said. "Why should I?" "Yeah, why should he?" the prisoners repeated as one. I was starting to feel pretty powerless, so I had to think, and think fast. "I'll tell you why," I said, "because if you don't cut out the raping, and pronto, I'll go to my cell and get my handmade knife, and that'll be the end of you." I made a mental note to fashion myself a handmade knife when I got back to my cell. "But I'm willing to make a deal with you, Adelman. We're both civilized men. You quit raping me right now, and there'll be no hard feelings. And you won't see a reprisal rape out of me either. I promise you that." Marvin stopped his raping for a minute, and I could see by the look on his face he was turning the offer over in his mind. "I don't know," he said. "I kind of like this feeling of power." "But rape isn't about power, Marvin. You've got it all wrong. It's about sex, don't you see?" I could tell this was confusing Marvin, and that gave me just the time I needed. I slammed my elbow into his spectacles. "I'm blind! I'm blind!" he screamed. "And you're raped as well," I said triumphantly, and I began my savage reprisal rape of Marvin Adelman, prisoner 6020311. "Now who's raping whom?" I asked. Adelman must have thought this was a rhetorical question because he just whimpered and cried, and my non-rhetorical question hung awkwardly in the air, unanswered, before I proclaimed, "I'm raping you, that's who." Just then a guard showed up. "You've done your time, McDonald, you're free to go." "I am?" I asked. "I thought I was in for 40 years. "Nope, 4 months. "Well, I'll be damned." We all had a good laugh at that one.
I was not always a ghost. As with all ghosts, I was once a living, breathing man. I lived in the city by the bay, and in a coffee house I sat at the feet of the masters and listened. There was Neil Cassidy, and Kerouac, too, and Ginsberg, who howled at the moon. They were beautiful, and they were my family. Now they are all ghosts, just like me. Only difference is, I'm alive. They were the young lions of beat, but their time was growing short when I arrived in the city. They had been replaced by hippies, who wore bright colors and danced and did psychedelic drugs. The year was 1966, and I had decided I would be the beatnik's biographer. I knew them all. I loved them. And I would write a book about these titans and let the world know these men, how they lived like no others, how they shook the literary world to its foundation. And so I shadowed them everywhere and asked them everything. And their answers were the greatest education a young writer could hope to receive. Burroughs, Kerouac, and Ginsberg were my main subjects. Julie Grau, a family friend who was working as a reader at Random House and was the first to believe in me, said that I had written a classic work of nonfiction, and soon my name would be known throughout the country. Unfortunately, Julie was right on both counts. I had grown very close to my subjects. Yes, they were geniuses, but to me they were family. And so I decided to name the book my beautiful family. Random House sent the advance copies out to the critics, and every single one heaped lavish praise on me. They heralded me as the next great American voice, and called the book a masterpiece. I could not believe it. At 20 years of age, I was sure to become the toast of the literary world. They all agreed with Julie that my name was about to become famous. And they were right as well. You see, my name was not Terence Keane at the time. But oh, how I wish that this had been my real name back then. Because when my work hit the bookshelves in late November of 1969, it contained the cursed name I was given at birth. A name unknown when the book was published, but widely known only days later. I will never forget the elation I felt when early on the morning of November 29th, I looked through the window of Rizzoli's on 57th Street and saw dozens of copies of my book on prominent display. There it was, My Beautiful Family by Charles Manson.
Chapter 20. The Devil, you say? So, Norm, how come you were only in prison for 4 months when you thought you were in for 40 years? Well, Adam Egan, I say, I just didn't hear right. The judge had given me a sentence of 4 months, but I thought he'd given me 40 years, which is longer. I'd played it right, though. I'd taken care of Lauren even from jail. He'd visit me every week at Riker's, and he'd always leave a few grains heavier. But how did the show cover all the time that you were gone, Norm? Well, that was just dumb luck. I'd only been on the show a handful of episodes, and nobody knew who I was when I was sent away. When I got out, I had 3 shows to go in the first season to prove myself, and I was determined to be a star. I should have been having the time of my life, wearing free world clothes and enjoying free world delights. You must have been living it up, huh? No, Adam Egget, not one bit. Sarah never left my mind. Don't tell me you kept trying to get her. Yes, Adam Egget. And it nearly cost me everything. I know this story will be hard to tell, so I measure out a double shot of morphine and press the Surette smoothly under my tongue. And once again, the present becomes the past. I was sitting at the bar drinking Wild Turkey 101 and talking aloud to myself. It's not fair. I'd do anything to have Sarah for my very own. Anything? Whispered a voice to my right. And I turned and faced the sneering smile and merry, wicked eyes of a stranger sitting next to me. Yeah, sure, stranger, I said. Why, I'd give up anything if only Sarah would love me the way that I love her. Perhaps I could be of service, the stranger said. And he threw his head back and roared a loud, mirthless laugh that filled the room. What you laughing at, mister? I said. I mean, no offense, but I've heard better jokes. His yellow eyes narrowed and hardened. Do you not know who I am? He hissed, and a vague whiff of sulfur touched my nose. Well, you're not Bob Hope, I'll tell you that. I mean, that joke fell flat, mister. You were the only one in the whole joint laughing. It was downright embarrassing. Silence! Bellowed the stranger, and now the sulfur fully invaded my nostrils, and I choked. I have been called by many names. Perhaps you know me as Lucifer, Mephistopheles, the Prince of Darkness, Beelzebub, Old Scratch, the Lord Host of the Hoary Netherworld, the Beast, the Archfiend, the Father of all Lies, the Great Deceiver, the Fallen Angel. I'm Satan himself. Sorry, buddy, never heard of you, I said, as I turned back to my half-finished Wild Turkey 101. I'm the devil, you moron, he said. So that was it. The devil. It all made sense now. The stench of brimstone, his wolfish yellow eyes and teeth, the red pitchfork leaning against his bar stool. I can make it so that this Sarah girl will love you with all her heart, said the unholy one. Sign this, and she is yours. The devil produced a parchment, tattered, yellow, and ancient, and placed it before me on the bar. It read, The one you love will love you forever. In exchange, you agree to give the devil your immortal soul, plus 2 beers. I then read the small print. The beers shall be Pabst Blue Ribbon. If they are out of Pabst Blue Ribbon, as is often the case in this particular establishment, then you shall give the devil your immortal soul, plus 2 of whatever's on draft. The price seemed a mite steep to me, but then I thought about how I hadn't lived such an upright life, and that if I refused the deal, but ended up down there anyhow, with the devil raping me for all of time, I'd feel like a right fool. "I'll do it," I said. The devil scratched my fingertip with his claw, and blood pooled there, as I shuddered and signed the hellish contract. I looked up at the Dark One, but just as he had suddenly appeared, so now he had suddenly vanished into the men's room. I settled up with the barkeep, 6 shots of Wild Turkey 101 that I'd drunk, and 2 Pabst Blue Ribbons for old Ned. 2 weeks went by, and I didn't see Sarah. Normally, a fortnight away from my one true love would have me pacing back and forth in my room like those big cats in the small cages over at the Central Park Zoo. But the funny thing is that when you know a girl loves you more than life itself, you can afford to play it cool. Real cool. When I finally broke and arrived at her threshold, Sarah looked surprised. "I don't know what to say, Norm," she stuttered. But words were needless now. Her eyes spoke to me of yearning, of want, and of need. I took Sarah into my arms and kissed her deep, and then deeper again. But no tongue. This was love, after all. The kiss calmed my doomed soul, and I felt like I was floating, calm, and everything was right in the world. Then I heard the hissing. It was steady, slow, and unrelenting. I recognized the sound immediately, as I had heard it many, many times before. It was the sound of mace. My eyes and lungs filled with the stuff, as I stumbled, blind and choking. When the sound finally ceased, I fell backward and hit the back of my head on something hard. I couldn't see or talk, but I could hear just fine. And what I heard was the sound of a purse being rummaged through, and then the unmistakable sound of another can of mace being opened. Then the hissing began again, and I scrabbled backward into a wall as I tried vainly to endure the spray of fire. By my estimate, the first assault had only been about a third of a can. This full can would be much, much worse. 3 times as bad if my calculations were correct. I could only hope that Sarah had escaped. I lost consciousness somewhere during all of this, but I'm here to tell you that nothing will wake you up faster than being thrown off a second-story balcony. I suppose I was lucky a cement alleyway was there to break my fall, but still, it hurt. It hurt like a bastard. I looked up at the balcony, and my beautiful Sarah was there. I was so happy she was okay. And not only was she okay, she was laughing. Well, that got me laughing, too. Although my laugh came out like a loose rattle and sprayed blood on the cement. That made Sarah laugh even harder. "Love sure is funny, isn't it, Sarah?" I croaked. "One second you're kissing and being in love and all, and the next second some guy breaks into your apartment and starts macing you and the fellow you love." "I don't love you, Norm. I hate your guts." I looked up at Sarah and instantly understood she was telling the truth. She did hate my guts. But she wasn't to blame. I was sure that Dave Attell had made his own diabolical deal. My quarrel was now with the devil himself. I dragged my broken body to the tavern, ordered a whiskey, and asked the barkeep where I could find the devil. He looked at me funny. "He was in here a couple of weeks back," I said. "Yellow wolfish eyes, diabolical laugh, carries a trident." "Oh, you must be talking about Phil Bradshaw," said the barkeep.
"He goes by many a name," I said. "Have you seen him?" "Bradshaw," hollered the barkeep. "Man out here looking for you." I spotted the fallen one in the corner, playing a game of Ms. Pac-Man and nursing a Pabst Blue Ribbon. A Pabst Blue Ribbon, I thought to myself. That means some other poor fool lost his soul tonight. "Well, well, well," I shouted angrily, "if it isn't the devil himself." "Where? Where?" the devil cried, looking first here, then there, searching the room. I saw a look of wild alarm in his lupine eyes. "Enough of your malarkey, devil. You reneged on your promise. My true love loves me not. And the way I see it, that means this contract is null and void." I pulled out the ancient parchment with my bloody signature. The devil regained his calm and looked up at me from his chair. He took the document and pulled out some reading glasses. "So, she doesn't love you back, huh?" "No, Sarah Silverman has nothing but ice in her heart for me." "Sarah Silverman?" asked the devil. "That's the girl who doesn't love you back?" "Yeah." "Well, you never told me it was Sarah Silverman. What are you, nuts? She's way out of your league, pal." "Listen, I'll tell you what I'll do. There's a girl who starts work here in about an hour. Sure, she's a little hefty, and her face isn't much to look at, but she's got real nice long hair. Now, if you were to sign another contract, she will be yours forever." And then he began his demoniacal laugh, but quickly thought better of it and pretended he was coughing. "You failed in your task, evil one, and so you must destroy this infernal contract and return to me my immortal soul," I insisted. "Trouble over there, Bradshaw?" I heard the barkeep yell across the room. "No, no, no, everything's just fine, Mr. Billingsley. No trouble at all." "Well, make sure you keep it that way."
"Yes, Mr. Billingsley, you bet. You won't hear a peep out of me."
The devil turned to me, and I saw he was suppressing his otherworldly rage. "Now look, if Sarah Silverman doesn't love you, then it is true I am technically in breach of this contract, but, you see, there's a problem." I gulped with fear.
"What's the problem?"
"The two beers. I can't swing it today. Best I can do is give you this one, but it's half empty. Otherwise, it might take me 5-6 days to get my hands on two beers. I haven't been making many deals lately. People are less and less ambitious. They're willing to settle, I guess, at least in this neighborhood." I looked in his evil eyes with dread. "So, my soul is yours?" I wept.
"Oh, your soul. Oh, right. Right, your soul. Well, I'll tell you what. How about I give you back your immortal soul, we forget all about the two beers, and I'll burn that contract right now."
He grabbed the parchment, borrowed a lighter from a nearby patron, and set it ablaze. My heart was filled with joy. True, I didn't win the love of Sarah Silverman, although I continued to try each day via unanswered phone calls, unanswered emails, unanswered yelling at her apartment door. But not everyone can say they beat the devil. Chapter 21, The Lost Days. I awakened from my blackout without hangover. As always, I feel fresh as a newborn. Of course, I have no memory, only the knowledge that I was happy where I was, and now I'm sad that I am back. In the way that a man, upon awakening, will feel nostalgia for his wonderful dream, even though it is forgotten before his feet hit the hard floor of his hard house. I know time has passed, and I know that I am lying fully clothed in a bathtub. I am cold, and it is hard to get up and stand. When I finally manage it, I look in the full-length mirror and am shocked. My face has some scabs, the small kind you get from falling on pavement, and I am bruised about the jaw and cheekbones. But I have come out of blackouts worse than that. What alarms me is that I am now a big fat guy. I have to have gained 75 pounds. "Adam Egott," I scream, and he comes in from the other room. I ask him the date, and he tells me, "That's over a month.
Over a month I've been blacked out? A month is a long time, and it feels even longer in Las Vegas, where a lot can change in very little time. Tell me what happened, Adam Egget. How bad was it?
Adam Egget yawns. Are you kidding? You couldn't lose. You don't remember it at all?
No, none of it, I laugh. But from the look of my round belly and my extra chin, I'm a prosperous man. I laugh some more and dance around the room. I'm going to go hit the tables. Where the hell's my money?
I'm sorry, Norm, but Gabe insisted all the money be kept in the safe.
Ha ha! Well, don't worry about it, friend. Gabe is a smart man, I say. Come and sit now, Adam Egget, and tell me exactly what I have been up to this past month. I sit on the edge of a chair and listen to my forgotten adventure. And what a picture Adam Egget paints. I had visited every casino on the strip with my two pals in tow. I had taken up with a beautiful Cree girl that I was set to marry, but then I got cold feet and may have lost the love of my life. I had outdrunk a local pimp who then went after me with a knife and almost killed me, but Gabe had used martial arts on this gentleman of leisure, and for that I owed him my life. I finally ended up here at Harrah's, where I'd been the talk of the floor, a man blind drunk who couldn't lose, who would hit 19 and find a 2. It all sounds wonderful, but part of me is sad, sad that it is another splinter of my life that has happened, and I will never remember it, another splinter that I have to take another person's word for. I'm going to quit drinking and be just like you, Adam Egget. We both laugh hard at that one. As we dance and laugh, Gabe walks in, and he is carrying 2 bags from 7-Eleven. He empties them into the middle of the room. Food spills everywhere. There are Twizzlers and Butterfingers, Rolos and Creamsicles and Paydays, and more and more and more. There you go, fatso. That ought to hold you for a while. He's back, Gabe. He's back. Yeah, I'm back, I say. I'm sorry I missed out on all the fun. Adam Egget says we've been to every casino in town. Yep, says Gabe. Listen, Gabe, I really want to thank you for taking care of that knife-wielding pimp I outdrank. Yeah, don't mention it. I never liked pimps, says Gabe. Love should never be for sale. Gabe is always saying wise words like these, words that you'd expect to see on a T-shirt or a coffee mug. I want to know if I'd made the million yet, and if not, how close I am. How much did I win, Gabe? How much did I win? Gabe just looks at me. How much did you win? You black out on whiskey and expect to wake up in a bed of cash? No, you wake up in a cold, hard bathtub, which is what you did. But Adam Egget told me I couldn't lose. Adam Egget has 2 Entenmann's donuts in his mouth. Oh, I was just talking about last night, Norm. You couldn't lose last night. Sorry for the misunderstanding. Sorry for the misunderstanding! I leap across the room and am on Adam Egget and choking him. But his ubiquitous sweat protects him. It's like trying to keep hold of a greased pig. But I stay on top of him and finally have him pinned to the floor. I'm throwing punches and Adam Egget is whimpering and crying. And I keep screaming, sorry for the misunderstanding! I feel Gabe on my back, trying to pry me loose, but my enormous girth prevents anything of the sort. It seems like Adam Egget is certain to die by my hand, but Gabe finally hits me across the back with a chair. The chair does not smash to pieces like in the movies, so he just keeps hitting me with it, until finally I roll over, finished. Gabe places the chair back where he found it. The chair looks fine. It hasn't lost a single splinter. I can barely breathe. Where do I stand, Gabe? You've worn out your credit at every casino. You owe $1 million, and you have roughly 70,000 from your hot streak last night. I try to get up, but I'm not used to all the extra weight, and my knees buckle. I crawl to the candy and empty a pack of Junior Mints in my mouth, then begin to unwrap a Butterfinger. Why am I eating like this, Gabe? What's going on? I've been thinking on that, says Gabe. Did you ever see the movie Milk? I love milk, says Adam Egget.
Right, Gabe says, but you mean you love to drink it out of a glass, or maybe put it on your cereal?
Oh, yes, says Adam Egget.
Well, this movie, Milk, it has nothing to do with that. It's about a politician in San Francisco who is killed by this crazy guy. And it was a true story. So when this guy goes on trial, the media dubs it the Twinkie defense, because this crazy guy ate a lot of Twinkies. But the media had it all wrong. They said the defense was claiming eating Twinkies made their client crazy. What the defense was really saying was that eating a lot of junk food was a symptom of mental illness. That when you're going crazy, your brain craves sugar.
Gabe, you trying to tell me I went crazy?
You went crazy, and you went fat.
I can still win, Gabe.
Gabe puts his mouth close to my ear. It may be time to begin readying yourself for Plan B.
Adam Egget and I take the last $70,000 over to the craps table. I bet $5,000 on every number, so I have $30,000 on the table. I know as I do it, I am out of control, but I cannot stop. Gabe was right, I'm still on tilt. My only hope now is to hit a run of good luck. Hitting a run of good luck at the exact time you are on tilt can make you a fortune fast. But instead I watch as my bankroll goes up, then down, then up again, and I think how this will likely be the last time I place money on a game of chance. I remember a psychiatrist once telling me that I gamble in order to escape the reality of life, and I told him that's why everyone does everything. But I've had plenty of wasted nights after losses and bigger losses to consider the question more seriously. So why the attraction? Most people would think it's the wins that keep the gambler going, but any gambler knows this is not true. As you place your chips on the craps table, you feel anxiety and impatience. When the red dice hit the green felt with a thunk, and you're declared the winner, and the chips are pushed toward you, you feel relief. Relief is all. And relief is fine. But hardly what a man would give the whole rest of his life to gain. It has to be something else. And the best I have come up with is this. It is a particular moment, a magic moment, that occurs after the placing of a bet, and before the result of that bet. It is after the red dice are thrown, but before they lie still on the green felt where they fall. It is when the dice are in the air, and as long as they are there, time stops. As long as the red dice are in the air, the gambler has hope. And hope is a wonderful thing to be addicted to.
Better luck next time, sir. In a casino, these are the words that tell you that you are broke. Better luck next time, sir. I stumble over to a chair by the slots. I light a cigarette and take a deep drag. When the casino takes all I have, I usually feel lost and don't know what to do, but this time is different. I know exactly what to do. I have Plan B. I find Adam Egget by the video Kino machine and take the news that he is up $1.85 in stride. Adam Egget, listen to me. Go now and find the man you think is a lady and stay with her somewhere, downtown. Somewhere you will be noticed. Start a fight in public. Make yourself seen. Tomorrow evening, return here and find me in my bed.
Gotcha, boss.
And Adam Egget turns on his heel to leave.
Whoa, 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 whoa! That's it? That's all you have to say?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to see it tomorrow night.
You never really understood Plan B, did you, Adam Egget?
Not really.
And so I have to explain the plan again to Adam Egget. And when he finally understands it, he begins to weep like a woman and asks me to promise that I will do no harm to myself. I will not promise that, Adam Egget, It goes against everything Plan B stands for. But remember this. When you come back tomorrow, it will not be me you find in the hotel room bed. And then I have him touch the flesh of my arm and the bones underneath. But only these clothes I wear. Adam Egert goes off into the night, and I go to my room. I sit on the edge of my bed and open the drawer. I take out the 600 milligrams of Dilaudid, the fresh Surette, and the Gideon's Bible. I read a few of my favorite scripture passages as I prepare the Surettes. And then I inject myself with the lethal dose of Dilaudid. I fall to my knees and rest my elbows on the bed. I pray forgiveness for what I am doing. And then I feel joy and peace fill my soul as my consciousness quietly drifts away. And then I don't die. Chapter 22, Meeting God. I find my way through the casino, and in a moment I am on the strip. There is a dry chill that begins to freeze my naked face, and the buildings of iron and glass feel as immortal as the ancient streets they sit upon. I look above, and the sun shining amid the blue sky and white, white clouds casts a pall of futility over the man-made monuments and their sickly neon light. And I stand by the Pyramid of Luxor and gaze upon the firmament above, and in a sudden the sky becomes a face, and I look away in fear and shame. It is the face of God, and he speaks, and his voice is both yours and mine at once, and he speaks unto me. Why do you not look at me, neither yesterday nor today? And so I remove my dirty work hat, and look upon him, and study his countenance. Now people always wonder if God is a man or a woman, or black or white or yellow, but I'm here to tell you that none of this silly stuff matters. He's a white guy, by the way. What matters is how truly big he is. He is bigger than the cities, than the world, than the sun. He is bigger than your hopes, your imaginings, your dreams, and even your ambitions. Plus, he has a mustache. And when I lock eyes with this supernatural giant, I feel the emptiness that I have always carried deep in my gut vanish, and a sudden quiet peace replaces it.
Wait a minute. Your eyes are weird. The pupils are all dilated. You aren't stoned, are you?
God looks concerned, and he moves his face close to inspect me. No!
Are you sure? 'Cause you look really stoned.
No, I mean, oh yeah, kinda. God throws up his hands and shakes his head in exasperation.
Well, that's just great, because I have come to you with a message for the people of Earth. And who better to deliver my message to the people of Earth than a stone guy? Doesn't get any more convincing than that.
Look, Lord, there's no need for sarcasm. Listen, maybe you should find someone else. I'm just a nightclub comic who travels across the country and gives people the gift of happiness with jokes about answering machines. I'm sure I'll go to heaven, right?
Fine, I'll find another. As far as going to heaven, I can't say.
Well, that really scares me, so I think fast. Hold on, hold on. It was only a joke. Of course I'm your guy. I'm your guy. I was kidding earlier when I said you should find someone else. It's so funny that you thought I was being serious because I was totally kidding. And the Lord begins to speak his message. Just as he begins, a second wave of the drug hits me, much harder, and the sidewalk becomes quicksand beneath my feet, and I sink into it fast. I clutch at a lamppost and hold on hard so that the sidewalk does not swallow me and fill my lungs with sand. Around me, I see, in a circle that grows ever smaller, a pack of wildcats sauntering nearer and nearer. and their green eyes shine, and their white teeth are slick with saliva, and their breath can be seen in the cold, cold air. Time that is beyond all human calculation passes, and a crash of thunder makes the mountain cats race up to the top of the Luxor Hotel, where they fasten themselves like gargoyles to the top of the pyramid. I am alone now, but for him. I look up, and he is making pronouncements, and he looks mighty and self-satisfied, too.
And it has to be in those exact words. Now, repeat them back to me.
And I say, I'm sorry, man. Some weird shit was going down. I wasn't listening.
Oh, well, that's cool. Don't worry about it.
But I can see that he is sulking. Hold on, I'll get a pencil. I race to the Luxor's gift shop to buy a pencil and a notebook from a half-man, half-alligator. And I am now ready to write down all his words, the better to convey them to the people of Earth.
Say unto them, redemption is near.
Got it. Redaction is near.
Redemption.
Revenging.
Redemption.
Got it. I say again, got it. I look down, and the pencil is the finger of a dead woman, and it is blue-black.
And the perfidy of man,
and the perfectly on man.
No! No! That's not even a word. Just focus.
I can tell that God is getting very frustrated, but it isn't my fault. God knows way more words than I do. And on it goes, with him making pronouncements and using very difficult words, and then me getting something wrong, and him getting all disappointed in me. Until finally it ends.
And such is the way to eternal bliss.
Got it, Chief, I say, and place my notebook and the dead woman's finger in my pocket.
Well?
Well, what, I say?
Well, what do you think of my speech to the people of Earth?
I'm sorry, but I was transcribing it, so I wasn't really listening. I can't do both. He is about to begin sulking again, so I quickly say, but you know what? I'm sure it's just great.
Yeah, right.
There's that sarcasm. But I can tell I've hurt his feelings as well. I guess everyone wants to be heard, even if it's your own creator. And his face is gone. And where it had been lies the sky, and on the sky lie the clouds and the moon and the stars. I look down at my scribblings and can't make out a word of it, due to my awful handwriting. It's too bad, but I can't do anything about it now, so I crumple up the paper and throw it on the sidewalk, and it bursts into a jagged flame, and thunder crashes in my ear. I know that he is not at all cool with my crumpling of his message, and I am afraid. That piece of paper had words upon it that would save the souls of all men, and I could have been the one to deliver them to the world. I could have spoken to all of mankind, and my name would have been one with Abraham and Moses and David. It's depressing, but that is not to be. And so I wander back to my hotel room and watch Tank Girl 4 times, back to back.
On November 30th, 1969, Charles Day reviewed my book in the New York Times Book Review. I have just heard the freshest voice in the last 50 years. It belongs to a young man named Charles Manson, and in his debut work he examines the life and work of this generation's most talented and influential writers. With his dizzying style and "you didn't have to be there" storytelling perfection, Charles Manson draws a perfectly observed portrait of the scene that produced the most famous beat artists. Charles Manson has a reckless style, cutting and dangerous, and he is happily willing to break every convention our literary society holds sacred. Yes, Charles Manson is dangerous, no question, but he also has a charisma that makes one forgive his savage style. I can assert without hesitation that My Beautiful Family is the best work, fiction or nonfiction, to be written in the last decade. It is a masterpiece that will live forever, and its author will be worshipped. The name Charles Manson may not be well known now, but trust me, it soon will be. And it soon was. 2 days after the review, the LAPD alleged that a small, clownish, deranged man had overseen an orgy of murder that had kept the nation in terror during the summer of hate in 1969. His name was Charles Manson, and he was charged with the murder of 7 people. But there was an 8th victim, and his name was Charles Manson. Not the Charles Manson who had overseen an orgy of murder that kept the nation in terror during the summer of hate in 1969. The other Charles Manson. Me. The next day, My Beautiful Family by Charles Manson was removed from every bookstore in the country. I stood with Julie Grau in Columbus Circle and watched as copy after copy of my book was thrown into a large bonfire.
Chapter 23, Make a Wish. Adam Egott walks in, sees me watching Tank Girl, and faints. I revive him, and he begins jumping up and down and shouting, "You're alive! You're alive!" He tries to hug me, but can't get his arms all the way around due to my girth, so it is only half a hug. I laugh. "Yes, Adam Egott, I am alive. I felt this life had nothing left to offer, but I was wrong. Life offers the squeals of delight as you pass a park filled with children. Life offers breakfast with a friend, drinking coffee and laughing at past mistakes. Life offers the kiss of a stranger, unexpected and thrilling. Life offers dilaudid. What a wonderful life. I almost tossed away." Adam Egott suddenly becomes serious. "Norm, when I thought that you had died, I wondered if you were in heaven or the other place. What do you think, Norm? Will we go to heaven? Are we good men?" The question stops me cold. I know we are not truly good men, but I cannot tell Adam Egott that. "Sure we are good. We saved a young boy, didn't we? We saved a young boy, who the doctor said was beyond saving." I can see Adam Egott is smiling now, and I will need to keep his spirits up. So I remind him the time we made a young boy's wish come true. It was the end of my first year on SNL, and even if I was never really on the show, just the fact that I was brushing up against it was making me a celebrity. And when you are a celebrity, everyone is always bugging you to do things. Good things. The boy had been alive 9 years, which made him young. But he would only be alive for one more year, which made him old. He was in a sad situation, and he had a wish that he needed my help to realize. It was a simple wish, to meet me and follow me around for a day at the Saturday Night Live TV show. As final wishes go, it seemed like a damn poor one. So that's why I was walking down a dim green hospital corridor that fine cold New York afternoon, instead of being where I should have, pitching my hysterical sketch about answering machines to Lorne Michaels for the following Saturday. But there are some things more important than television programs. I knew that dragging a terminally ill child around the studio for a whole day was sure to make me the laughingstock of my co-workers and could potentially get me fired. But sometimes you have to look at the big picture. The truth was, I had not lived an upright life, what with the shoplifting, the adultery, the taking of the Lord's name in vain, the coveting of my neighbor's ox. God damn it, I loved that ox. And the worshipping of that golden calf every time God didn't answer one of my countless prayers. I needed to do something exceptionally selfless to even up the books come Judgment Day and keep me from the devil's grasp for all of eternity. Making this boy's wish come true seemed like it just might do the trick. I don't much like hospitals, and I said as much when I met the boy's physician. "You may as well know, Doc, I'm no fan of diseases, and I'll never understand filling a whole building with them." "What are you, an idiot?" said the doctor. "Oh, yeah, I'm an idiot, all right. An idiot just like Alfred Einstein.
I'll have you know that I'm Norm MacDonald, and I work on the Saturday Night Live TV show, and I am a big shot. Saturday Night Live? That show hasn't been funny since Bill Murray left. A crowd was beginning to form, which was perfect for me, since I was a stand-up comedian. I decided I would put this doctor in his place. If you think it's so easy being funny, Doc, then why don't you tell us all a joke? So he did. And it was one of the funniest jokes I'd ever heard. I'll never forget it. His timing was flawless. A moth goes into a podiatrist's office. The podiatrist says, "What's the problem?" The moth says, "Where do I begin with my problems? Every day I go to work for Gregory Vasilievich, and all day long I toil. But what is my work? I am a bureaucrat, and so every day I joylessly move papers from one place to another and then back again. I no longer know what it is that I actually do, and I don't even know if Gregory Vasilievich knows. He only knows that he has power over me, and this seems to bring him much happiness. And where is my happiness? It is when I awake in the morning, and I do not know who I am. In that single moment, I am happy. In that single moment, before the memory of who I am strikes me like a cane, and I take to the streets and walk in a malaise, here and then there and then here again. Then it is time for work. Others stop asking me what I do for a living long ago, for they know I will have no answer, and will fix my empty eyes upon them, and they fear my melancholia might prove so deep as to be contagious. Sometimes, Doc, in the deepest dark of night, I awake in my bed and I turn to my right, and with horror I see some old lady lying on my arm, an old lady that I once loved, Doc, in whose flesh I once found splendor, and now see only decay, an old lady who insults me by her very existence. Once, Doc, when I was young, I flew into a spider web and was trapped. In my panic, I smashed my wings till the dust flew from them, but it did not free me, and only alerted the spider. The spider moved toward me, and I became still, and the spider stopped. I had heard many stories from my elders about spiders, about how they would sink their fangs into your cephalothorax, and you would be paralyzed but aware, as the spider slowly devoured you. So I remained as still as possible, but when the spider again began moving toward me, I smashed my wing again into my cage of silk, and this time it worked. I cut into the web and freed myself and flew skyward. I was free and filled with joy. But this joy soon turned to horror. I looked down and saw that in my escape I had taken with me a single strand of silk, and at the end of the strand was the spider, who was scrambling upward toward me. Was I to die high in the sky where no spider should be? I flew this way, then that, and finally I freed myself from the strand and watched as it floated earthward with the spider. But days later a strange feeling descended upon my soul, Doc. I began to feel that my life was that single strand of silk with a deadly spider racing up it and toward me. And I felt that I had already been bitten by his venomous fangs, and that I was living in a state of paralysis as life devoured me whole. My daughter, Alexandria, fell to the cold of last winter. The cold took her, as it did many of us, and so my family mourned. And I placed on my countenance the look of grief, Doc, but it was a masquerade. I felt no grief for my dead daughter, but only envy. And so I have one child now, a boy, whose name is Stefan Mikhailovich Smokovnikov. And I tell you now, Doc, with great and deep shame, the terrible truth. I no longer love him. When I look into his eyes, all I see is the same cowardice that I see when I catch a glimpse of my own eyes in a mirror. It is this cowardice that keeps me living, Doc. That keeps me moving from place to place, saying hello and goodbye, eating though hunger has long left me, walking without destination, and at night